I'm Andrew Coates. I'm the host of the Live Free and Diet Hard podcast, episode 310, Lifetime. I know, I've been doing this for over 6 years. I recently had Dean Somerset on, and he made a big deal about that. He was actually my number one guest way back when with my old podcast co-host, Dean Guido. But we march on, and after a little bit of intermittent recording because of travel and whatnot, I seem to be back in a rhythm, and I've been bugging my friend, Dr. Susie Spurlock, aka Dr. Susie Squats on Instagram, to come on for quite a while. Susie's been on my other now defunct podcast. And Susie is, well, a doctor of physical therapy, a strength coach. You are gaining more traction as an educator. You are part of Barbell Rehab. I've had Dr. Michael Mash on before. If you like this episode, you may want to go back to Michael's episode. He's great. And I recently got to see you hang out with you in Las Vegas in March because you were one of the speakers at the Real Coaches Summit, Aram Grigorian's event. That was really cool.
That was really cool. So that was like my first debut of an in-person summit conference as a speaker. So I was really excited about that and couldn't have said more positive things about the summit itself and the experience. And just how good it felt to be able to stand up in front of people and help educate them on a bunch of things. I specifically talked about how to help coaches and even rehab professionals keep their clients working out in the gym, even in the presence of pain, just because we all experience pain. Like I have some back pain right now today, but that's not going to stop me from being active and moving about. And I just want other coaches to know about that. So that was a blast.
It is the coolest feeling ever. And obviously, depending on what Aram is able to do with the event next year, if he makes any changes, my plan is to be there because I just went to attend and hang out. Right? I had spoken the previous year and he goes all new speakers each year. And I've run into people. I think there are people in the industry who've earned the right and they're busy and they're in demand that, you know, the only events they're going to get to go to are going to be things that they're paid to speak at. But I still pick my spots and I still want to go and just be boots on the ground. There were a ton of friends of mine there. A whole bunch of speakers are my friends. I want to go and support Aram. And Aram was just texting me saying he has booked his tickets and flight to come up to my event in September here in Edmonton. So that just shows.
I love that. Yeah, just knows like how, even though I feel like, you know, with social media and the fitness industry, it is so large, but at the end of the day, it is actually a lot smaller than I think people realize when it comes to the people that support each other and have their little niche when it comes to education and putting out good information and things like that.
Well, I would bet that just the simple act of you attending Raise the Bar last year, probably one of the most important inflection points in your career for opening up these opportunities, because you would have met Aram in person at that event, right?
I did. I met Aram. I also met Dr. Michael Mash for Barbell Rehab. So not only did I get invited to come speak in Vegas at Aram's event and also a bunch of virtual summits throughout last year and this year, but it opened up the door for the opportunity for me to educate and teach for Barbell Rehab.
And because obviously going to Raise the Bar puts you more on Nick Lamb's radar, who's one half of Raise the Bar, and he's the one behind virtually all of these virtual events,
teams,
right? So I can't stress it enough. If you guys have this ambition and it doesn't guarantee anything, but get boots on the ground at events like these. They're great.
And they're fun too. Like they are just a blast to go to and hang out with everyone. And just, you know, because social media is great. We all get to talk and chat and support each other on there, but nothing really beats like that in-person connection and just, you know, getting to know people on a different level.
It's been one of the best things I've ever done with my career. And I can definitely owe a lot of the opportunities I've received, certainly all the public speaking stuff, to actually just loving going and attending these events. And yes, there is an investment, there's a financial cost to it, but I look at the financial return across my career, and there's definitely a very strong relationship, and the benefits have vastly out-rewarded me financially compared to the upfront money that I've spent traveling to something.
Exactly. And, you know, for any coaches or clinicians listening, you can write that trip off on your taxes if you own your own business, which is a very nice little way to do something beneficial for yourself and then also benefit you on the back end for taxes.
Well, I'm going to be spending more than enough time pumping my event coming up, Evolve Strength Business and Coaching Conference, September 13th and 14th. And I'm going to try to get some of the upcoming speakers on future episodes. Well, let's go back to you. And I actually want to talk about the physical therapy realm. So, more and more, we're seeing a lot of people like yourself very visible on social media talking about physical therapy. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I sort of have a theory. And 10 to 15 years ago, we saw, the popularization of the functional craze, we'll call it, right? Which of course got bastardized. We're seeing a lot of loaded, unstable surface type stuff, which is one of the direct manifestations of what I'm going to talk about. And I think some of this was born from trainers watching rehab professionals and physical therapists and looking at the things that they were doing in a clinical setting and going, well, if that's good for rehab, if we scale the resistance and the stimulus, this should be good for strength training. And that kind of took hold. And a lot of that stuff we now know doesn't work very well, right? I'm going
Correct.
to let you go further with it. But what I think has now happened, it's flipped. I think that the research, you're seeing people like Adam Meekins, who is one of my favorite follows. I mean, he's definitely like a little bit irascible at times. It's now we're seeming to understand that it's actually like strength and conditioning principles regressed in a stimulus to deal with a, like an injury. That seems to be the way to rehab individuals. So could you at least speak on that? And then I want to hear about like what's the evolution now of how we're approaching that intersection of rehabilitation and fitness.
Of course. So I definitely have seen that shift as well. Everyone was super obsessed with putting bands on everything and standing on Bosu balls and also back squatting and all that stuff years ago, which please don't do that. There is no benefit to doing that when it comes to strength training because you need to be on the flat ground, you need to have stability. And even in the rehab world, when we're rehabbing certain injuries, the thought was, oh, well, we're going to put you on an unstable surface so that we can build proprioception, which is essentially your body's way of knowing where you're at in space and also helping like increase your balance. But when we think about the surfaces we interact with on a daily basis, they're all stable and they're all flat. So there are so many more ways and better ways in order to increase balance, increase proprioception, increase just your body's awareness of the environment than standing on a Bosu ball. So even though I know some rehab professionals still use that stuff in the clinic today, it is a little bit outdated. Yes, the nuance always matters, and there is sometimes a time and a place for that stuff. But for the majority of people, we want them on the flat ground and doing things by manipulating the environment in order to get the effects that we want in regards to strength, proprioception, balance, all that fun stuff. But like you said, things have kind of shifted from bringing more strength and conditioning and personal training-esque things into the rehab world. Because the more research that has come out in the last 5, 10 years, the more we know that when people go to a traditional physical therapy clinic, so this is like a clinic that you get a referral from your primary care provider, and you go in and you're there for like 2 days a week for 6 to 8 weeks, most of those clinics are vastly underloading people and the tissues that we are trying to rehab, whether it's muscle, tendon, recovering from a surgery, whether it's a knee replacement, hip replacement, ACL, they're getting vastly underloaded because physical therapy clinics are not equipped with the proper equipment, and physical therapists are traditionally not equipped with the proper knowledge in order to bring in these strength and conditioning principles into the rehab realm. Fun fact is, I don't know how it is in Canada, but I know here in the United States, we as physical therapists don't get any education on basics of weightlifting or loading or kettlebell work or conditioning in PT school. It's mainly focused on special tests that we use to try and diagnose what could be going on with someone, and then a bunch of like banded exercises, essentially. So there's like a still to this day a huge gap between physical therapy that's outdated principles 15, 10, 15 years ago to where we are now. And you will find a group of us, which I'm sure is all the PTs that you interact with online, who are pushing for the more athletic and strength-based rehab versus your traditional, like, here's a really light resistance band, go through a bunch of these little shoulder external ranges of motion, and voila, your shoulder rotator cuff tear is healed.
And I'll throw a few more names in. I think Dr. Sam Spinelli is one of the
Yep.
forefront people on this. I mean, just go watch Sam lift. I just looked today and he was doing some sort of strongman competition. And Sam is 6'5". Like, he's muscular but lean, and just his force output is insane. So doctor of physical therapy, great educator. I mentioned Adam Meekins. Like, not everybody loves Adam because Adam can like pick fights with various people, but at the same time, a lot of the fights he's picking, I'm inclined to agree with him. And I've learned probably more from Adam, the combination of Adam and Sam about this stuff, and you and a handful of other people. I think there's some other great physios. I really like what Quinn Hennick has been doing for a really long time. Obviously, Dr. Michael Mash is huge. And there's a handful of others. Dr. Justin Farnsworth is someone I think is doing a really great job with this stuff.
He is.
And it's nice to see. So I want to highlight this stuff. So I think there's a whole bunch of stuff here. Like, let's tease out a bunch of stuff. So could you explain why traditional meth, okay, so how passive modalities, let's say like dry needling and stuff, work, why people can overvalue them or think that they have, like, what are their actual benefits? And can you explain the phenomenon of regression to the mean when it comes to injuries, healing, and pain? Because that's an important concept here.
So when it comes to modalities are, well, in the physical therapy world, modalities are usually things like electrical stimulation, where we put those little pads on you and then it pulses, things like therapeutic ultrasound, which is basically a deep heat version with a little wand on your skin with some gel to try and heat the tissues underneath. Paraffin baths, where you're like sticking your hand in some little hot wax. So all of those modalities used to have a ton of weight in the physical therapy world. You would go into a clinic, you would get 10 to 15, maybe even 20 minutes of this stuff. Then someone would come over, whether it was a PT or a physical therapy assistant, perform some sort of manual therapy on you, whether they were trying to do some joint mobilizations or soft tissue work to try and help, in quote, release any trigger points. And then you might maybe get to do a few exercises after that. And so this is where traditional therapy started. And then when we talk about things like dry needling, which is using the same needles as acupuncture and sticking it exactly into the muscle or the region that is having some discomfort, versus the acupuncture thought of where we're sticking it in a place, like if you're having like neck pain, we might stick it in your hand so that we are following those meridians in order to try and release the tissue. And then we also have things like cupping, where that became really popular in the Olympics many years ago when Michael Phelps was swimming and he had all those little like octopus looking circles on his back. And then we also have, what am I missing? Oh, manual therapy kind of falls in there, and so does foam rolling. So all of those things, we used to think that the body had trigger points, meaning that a muscle was kind of like tied up like a little knotted ball. And then we would use some of these things on that muscle, and that muscle would essentially like release. And we thought that we were definitely working and manipulating the tissue itself, which, yes, we do have some physiological effects at the tissue that we're targeting. However, we now know that the majority of the benefit we get from things like dry needling and cupping and foam rolling come from actually our response from the nervous system. So we are putting our hands on people, we are sticking needles in certain places. And what that's doing is that's talking directly to the nervous system of saying, hey, something is changing within this area of the body, and it is time for you to chill the heck out. Stop holding on to so much tension. This can actually also help kind of talk to those pain pathways and decrease the amount of pain that you're having. We can also see a temporary increase in range of motion in certain joints and muscles. But the key word here is temporary. So go ahead.
So this is where I wanted you to go. Okay, good. Keep going, please. I love it.
Keywords temporary. So it's not useless. I'm not anti-manual therapy, anti-dry needling, anti-cupping. But what needs to happen is if someone is going to use these things, these manual therapy techniques, it needs to be followed up with loaded exercise, because now we have this small window where we have decreased pain, increased range of motion, decreased sensitivity. Now we're going to load it so that we can talk to the nervous system and be like, hey, it's okay to be in these certain ranges. You don't have to freak out so much when the shoulder joint goes into this amount of external rotation. Because if we don't follow it up with those things, Now you're going to have some short-term relief, whether it's a couple hours, whether it's a couple days. And then guess what? The nervous system is super smart, and our body loves to be in a state where things are like most efficient. So it's your body's going to return to how it was prior to getting these modalities or this manual therapy done. So that is the benefit of manual therapy. We can get a good response, and we know this, but it's happening mostly because of the nervous system. So like I said, a little bit of the physiological effect within the muscle itself, but mostly nervous system, small window of opportunity to load things, increase range of motion, make some gains.
So I put up a post yesterday. It always gets a rise out of people. I reuse it about how it's like if your workout, or sorry, if your warm up is longer than your workout, like these people have been doing these crazy long workouts. We get some of the literature out there about like things like band distractions. I'm in a gym where you see a lot of power lifters, and I notice the band distractions have largely gone away, where someone like wraps a band around like a rack that puts it in their shoulder or like whatever, wraps something around their knee, and then they're like moving it around a whole bunch. And so this is one of these things, as you said, it temporarily relaxes the tone of tight muscles, allowing for extra range of motion. So that's how I approach this. But I think, well, number one is because this is so temporary, if you have these really extended warm-ups, and if you're moving around your body, the effects of this warm-up is actually wearing off. Now, deference to someone who has an injury and needs to spend a bit more time on something specific. Would you agree with the fact that, like, if let's say someone is dealing with some sort of injury, they're almost be better off getting to their workout quicker, lightly loaded sets of what they're doing, and then maybe things like foam rolling, because foam rolling I like as a thing that temporarily relaxes the neural tone of some tense site, and you can do it in between your sets to make your workouts efficient. Do you want to speak on that?
Yeah, so foam rolling can be a great little thing to spend 5 or less minutes on as a part of your warm-up, where you are essentially lying your body on a piece of foam and rolling back and forth, essentially giving yourself like a little mini self-massage. We are not breaking up adhesions, we are not elongating the muscle. We are not blasting the fascia. What we are doing is stimulating the nervous system. So with that, if you want to do some foam rolling before your workout, by all means, go for it. But don't really spend more than like maybe 5 minutes on it, or just doing a couple areas. There's no need to do a whole foam rolling body session. And there's no really need to try and also sort of foam roll the entire length of the muscle. A lot of times I'll see people, let's just like use the quads, for example, where they're lying on the foam roller and they're like rolling the entire length of that muscle. And you know, it looks interesting. And we know from the research that you don't have to do that. You can just literally lay on a foam roller on your quad and go back and forth a couple inches, back and forth, back and forth, and then stay still on the foam roller and bend and straighten your knee. And then you're going to get all those benefits. With that, like you said, there are some times where you can do foam rolling as part of your rest breaks. I would like to caution that I personally prefer to do it prior to a lift to sort of relax the nervous system just a tad and then ramp things back up versus do it in between my sets, just because now we are going for a state of hyping up the sympathetic nervous system for, let's say, like something like a back squat. And then during our rest breaks, we are now tapping into the parasympathetic nervous system, which is like the rest and digest during the sets, where we kind of want to stay a little bit more in that ramped up. So, I mean, but like with anything, like there's nuance. If you do that for your sets and that feels good and it's not taking away from your workout, you're still loading, you are still pushing for those strength metrics, and you're not really seeing a drop in your strength, then by all means, go for it. There's always like two different answers to a question or a statement. And traditionally, people like to think in black and white, but like all of the really good coaches and really good physios and rehab professionals are going to live in that gray area there.
Not unlike the argument against doing a lot of static stretching. And again, before something to improve range of motion of a joint, we need the access to. And I'll sometimes like, let's say the proverbial tight calves, stiff ankles. And so I'll oftentimes get people to roll their calves or do a little bit of calf stretching before we get into squatting. And then what tends to warm everything up and get you moving really well is just doing light squatting. I like goblet squats as a precursor for like regular squats if someone needs a bit more of a warm up. And then, but if we were to go and do a whole bunch of static stretching right before the heaviest loads, the research on this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was sort of overstated initially. There was a lot of fear, oh, don't stretch or you're like a lot weaker. It's not really that strong effect, but technically speaking, because you're relaxing that nervous system tension and the elasticity of the tissue a little bit, we're going to lose some strength at the top end. So you wouldn't want to stretch right before your heavy sets of something, right?
Right. And I think I wish I remember the name of the article that really dove into it. But essentially, if you want to do a little bit of static stretching prior to a lift, that's fine. But we kind of want to keep it under that 2 minute mark of static holds, because if the research study found like over the 2 minutes where we are holding stretches for longer and spending a lot of time stretching one specific joint or muscle, that's where you'll start to see the decrease in those strength gains as you get to the top end. But a little bit of static stretching before is totally fine.
So this is why I want to have you on, because like the depth of knowledge here is really evident. So I asked earlier, but we didn't get into it. So can you explain the context of regression to the mean when it comes to pain and injury? So and why that can contribute to the illusion that some of these passive modalities we talked about are having an outsized effect. And I guess the placebo effect also applies here too, right?
Yeah, so there's going to be a big placebo effect too, because if you have someone who believes that cupping is going to solve all of their pain and their issues, yes, we're talking to the nervous system and we're getting that response there. But what a lot of people forget is pain in itself has a huge psychological and emotional component to it, not just the physical, like with our bones and our muscles itself, but our beliefs around if something's going to work, our beliefs around pain, and then also just our emotional state as well. So all of these factors, this day and age is called the biopsychosocial model. Bio meaning the physical, psycho meaning kind of the beliefs around your pain, and then the social meaning all the social things in your life that can affect it, your family support, your stress levels at work. So pain is a lot more than just this muscle hurts, something is wrong with this muscle. It's a total sort of whole human experience. And so that's one of the reasons why a lot of this stuff can work. But then, if you have someone who's on the other side of the spectrum that is like, oh, manual therapy doesn't work at all, cupping doesn't work at all, it's all a crock of shit, and all I need to do is get under the bar and lift. Well, odds are these modalities may not work as well for that person versus the person that's really bought into these things. Either way, education is going to be a huge piece in trying to help someone get out of pain. And with that being said, reading the person you're in front of is also huge, because if someone is convinced that foam rolling breaks up trigger points and adhesions and elongates the fascia, then I'm not going to go straight in and be like, oh, yeah, well, you're wrong. It doesn't actually do any of that, because now you just totally got rid of all the rapport that you could possibly build up with this person or this client. So it's more about like building that relationship and then asking them, hey, are you open to hearing about what this actually does to your body from what we know now versus what we knew then? I know I keep going off on tangents. I'm so sorry.
It's all good. Well, I'll bring something back here. It's because, I mean, I have lots of clients who I send to a group of physical therapists who are all very good at strength training, and that becomes a component of it. But I tend to take care of a lot of the strength aspects of it, and the physical therapist should trust that. But in some cases, they go in for passive treatments because something is flared up, something's pissed off. Now, what I was saying about the regression mean is if someone has sort of a chronic nagging injury or pain, it's not always this linear, static level of whatever is wrong. It can vacillate. So we sometimes see aggravation of that pain. Those type of injuries tend to be a little bit worse. So number one is the regression to the mean is they're going to, on average, go back to their baseline. That is typically what tends to happen with most of these things. I mean, not like an ACL that gets ripped off or something of that nature, but most of the aches and pains. And if you go in and if the passive treatment, dry needling with a strong placebo effect, they feel good. Another thing I was going to throw in there earlier, like you mentioned manual therapy, there's actually something unique like massage and manual therapy, human touch. That's literally a powerful thing, right? Oxytocin, all that sort of stuff. So that plays a role. So if you layer all those things in and someone comes out and feels better, psychologically, they feel good about it, they trust the process, they know coming back, it may be enough to relax things, they feel better to where the pain or the injury also regresses to its mean state as well. Is that true?
Yep, that is true. But with that, we also need to load, like I talked about earlier, because, yes, all of these modalities and treatment things that you can typically get in a rehab setting can help you regress towards the mean of getting back to your baseline, getting out of that chronic and or acute state of discomfort and pain. But unless we build up the tissue tolerance and build up the desensitization to the nervous system as a whole in that certain region, you're probably going to kind of teeter further away from the mean to where we are still having some symptoms and some flare-ups because we can't just solely kind of rely on these modalities and these manual therapy and this dry needling and this cupping. We have to teach the body, teach the client, teach the brain that it is okay to move into these certain regions or load up a barbell back squat that previously caused hip pinching because now we're tapping on not only the psychological aspect of it, but also the physical.
So another thing that's part of this, I guess, revolution in the social media side of the evidence-based physical therapists, they're very big on a few narratives that I agree with. Number one is we want to get people away from fear of movement load. And we have people within the physical therapy realm and in the strength world who perpetuate a lot of fear-based stuff. If you don't, like one of my favorite ones, is you have to earn your right to load your squat. You end up having to do a perfect body weight squat in order to put a bar on you. And I think this is rubbish because what I like to always say is I can't count the number of times I work with a new client who didn't have great motor skills, not super great proprioception, and their body weight squat looked like a baby giraffe on ice. I've given them on a like a light, moderate dumbbell goblet in hands. And without any other cueing, it cleans up the motion like magic. Thoughts?
Anyone who tells you have to earn the right to use a barbell or back squat or do whatever exercise, total bullshit. Because you're already there. Like if you're not having a bunch of discomfort and things feel relatively okay, even if you are having discomfort, there's always like an entry point exercise that we can get into and we can progress that within the same session. We don't have to be able to squat half of our body weight with a goblet squat for 12 reps. I've seen that float around. I'm not naming names on this podcast, but there are certain belief systems where you have to go through, you have to be able to do a push-up, and then you have to be able to do a dumbbell chest press, and then a bottom-up kettlebell chest press. And then if you can check all those boxes off and you have all this range of motion in your shoulder, then you can finally earn the right to touch a barbell. It's rubbish. Like you said, some people's, actually, most people's body weight squats look different from their loaded squat, regardless of what you use, whether it's a goblet squat, front squat, a back squat. I mean, hell, mine even looks vastly different. And I know I've seen this picture float around, and I forget who the athlete was, but a famous o Olympic weightlifter who failed the fun overhead functional movement screen portion of the FMS test. With a dowel, but he can literally hoist hundreds of pounds over his head just fine when the bar's loaded.
The load itself would alter the way that the nervous system interacts
Correct.
with
Correct.
movement anyway, right?
Yes, because now we are taking just a bodyweight exercise, and now we're giving someone load, which creates more tension, which creates the body's ability to tap into having to use a bunch of the other stabilizing muscles, and the person themselves have to focus more just because they're holding a load. And so, all of these things combined, our bodies are really, really good at being able to self-organize. And I think a huge misconception with a lot of coaches and clinicians missing the boat is that they don't give their clients and patients time to let their bodies self-organize. It's kind of like, fuck around and find out sort of mentality to an extent, but we're not going willy-nilly and just tossing 135 pounds on someone's back. We are kind of going through a little bit of a system in order to see which variation of a movement pattern they're able to load.
You mentioned functional movement screen. That is one of the modalities that I will openly say is complete bullshit. So I'll
I'll
add
say
some context.
I'll agree with that.
I'll add some context. So, but the people behind functional movement screen, it's a very old system. Even themselves have shifted what they've claimed it does. It has no relationship with like what someone's score is on a functional movement screen has no preventative or predictive validity for injury, future injury for that person. And that's really the thing that matters. Could a coach go and learn the functional movement screen, understand how people are moving? Sure, no problem. But I actually have a very strong philosophy here, and I've seen smart people that I like pretty sure Ben Bruno's one of the ones in this camp. And I think more and more of the smart trainers are spending less time on very detailed, elaborate screening things before they train someone. My assessments largely are like, I find most basic movement patterns regress to lightly loaded are excellent quote movement screens. You can tell. Let's give some training examples. So I like doing landmine presses with most general population clients.
Me
It
too.
is rare to find someone who, all but the most destroyed shoulders, generally speaking, can do a landmine press relatively pain-free. And outside of like really small deconditioned women, if I had an empty bar, most people can do pretty good, right? And you can do two-handed, you can play around a little bit, it's not quite the same. And by that, like a lightly loaded goblet squat, that's you can see someone's squat pattern there. You can probably go in knowing a little bit whether or not someone's probably going to be able to turn around and do a good hinge or Romanian deadlift. You just kind of know different clientele. Someone will surprise you. Like my client, Larry.
Oh,
Larry has one of
Larry.
the best looking Romanian deadlift hinges you will ever see on a person, and you would not expect it, right? But guys, on average, women seem to do it naturally. Guys, whew, oh boy, that's fun. So there are so many of these fairly basic movement patterns. A basic row, you sit someone in a seated cable row or something of that nature, or a farmer's carry. Guess what? What the issue I have is if you sit down and you meet with a person and you talk to them for an hour first meeting, and then the next time you meet them, it's an hour long minimally loaded assessment. By the time they finally get to the exercise, some of the excitement's worn off. So I actually want to get to the exercise, and you can assess by lightly loading and having them move, and you find out, do they like this? Are they moving well? Are they pain-free? Watch their reactions to this stuff instead of this. And I hate this if you're not assessing, you're guessing bullshit. That's one of my, like, it's one of the dumbest pieces of rhetoric I see in the industry. It gets me kind of mad. It's like everything we're doing is assessing people, right? And there are, again, a series of fairly basic foundational movement patterns. Dan John popularized them, et cetera, that we just know people are going to do. And the person who cannot do a like a 90 degree back position overhead press because they just don't have the overhead mobility. Shit, I don't have that overhead mobility. A lot of people don't. Landmine, that's where it comes in. Or we can have a slight incline, press some light dumbbells, see if someone has access to it without like arching out their back. We figure out what they can do. You load, you warm them up. That's another thing. It's just by warming people up, all of a sudden, wait a second, they've got more range of motion after two sets. Gee, I wonder what was going on there. The nervous system is being, adjusted, changed, right? State of the nervous system. So this is actually my philosophy, and I'm seeing more, most of the, what I think the smarter people in the industry tend to subscribe to this. Thoughts?
110% agree and support that, and so does the literature. So I actually used to be someone that followed the if you're not assessing, you're guessing sort of mantra. I have thankfully since then moved away from that because the last thing someone needs to do when they come in for a physical therapy appointment or a evaluation or they have their first workout or assessment with a coach or a trainer is stand there and have all the things that they're doing wrong or all the deficits they have in their body pointed out. Because guess what that does? That makes them feel like shit. They're no longer excited for working out or going through a plan of care with physical therapy. And you're already sort of now placing a little bit of preconceived fear in them when it comes to certain movements. Because a lot of times, like, let's say we have decreased hip external rotation mobility, and someone finds that on assessment, whether it's a coach or a clinician, and you're like, oh, yeah, well, we need to really try and work on this because I don't want you to load up a back squat and then not have that external rotation mobility. And then that can really damage your hips in the long run and lead to a lot of things down the line where now you're going to be hurting. Well, guess what? You just did. You just made this person who may not have been afraid of a back squat before now afraid of a back squat, whether it's a back squat, front squat, goblet squat, I don't care. And so something that I love doing and that have now shifted towards over the past 5 years or so is doing a little like your first workout. So a lot of times I won't even label it an assessment. I'll just say, oh, this is your first workout. Here's what I want to see. I want to see you do a horizontal pushing, horizontal pressing, vertical pushing, horizontal pushing, and then a squat, and then a hinge, and then a lunge. And then guess what? I'm going to watch you during your first workout. And if I see things that I could give a couple cues to help improve, great, we're going to do that. if I see areas of where I'm like, hey, I actually want to take a look at their hip rotation mobility because they seem really limited with internal rotation on their hinge pattern, then that's what I'm going to sort of tease out and add in more of these true assessment-based things. But when I do these more assessment-based things, I'm not saying, oh, look how weak you are, or look how much range of motion you're lacking. I'm saying, hey, we have some room for improvement on your strength of your hip flexors or your hip rotation mobility. We're going to work on that while we still are able to load you in a way that's going to help us get from point A to point B. So instead of calling these things deficits or weaknesses, call them areas of room for improvement. And then also point out a lot of the good stuff that you see during all the other movements that they're completing for you.
And you could also have fun with the way that you say things. One of my favorite
Exactly.
ways to do this is, let's say I got a new client, right? Or someone hasn't been around in a while. And then they notice that they're not performing, they're not super strong at something. And I'll say, no. And then they might say, hey, I'm weak. And I'll be like, no, you're deconditioned. And then I'll smile because that's a kind of a big word. So we don't want to get too lexiconal on them. So then I smile at them and say, that's just a really like polite technical term for, you're a little weaker right now, so don't worry. And it always gets a little bit of a laugh. So we've actually been able to be honest about it, but it completely takes the nastiness of the sting out of it. There's something else that I've kind of swung on a bit. Now, I don't start people out in a whole bunch of machines, but I came from the philosophy of, okay, like free weights are better than machines. We now know the research on this that machines are just as good at developing strength, they're just as good at building muscle. But a concept that really near and dear to me is stability. So, and particularly, I like to frame it as external reference. So the amount of positions of external reference, touch points, external stability that we can like touch, hold on to, or we're braced against. And I think about in terms of multiple positions and the surface area. So a really good dichotomy here, bit of a false one. Is you think about a squat. How much external reference do we have with a squat? We have the surface area of our 2 feet and the fact that we have the balance between the 2 feet, right? Like a single leg, like a pistol, is not one half of the amount of a bilateral squat. Like that's infinitely more difficult. But then you sit someone in a leg press, and some people don't like leg presses. Guess what? Leg press, tons of external stability. That person, as long as they feel safe with the idea of it, cool, they can sit in this, they can move some serious load, they can produce a ton of tension on this thing, they can get a really crazy good workout. And if you've got someone who walks in and they're actually kind of tired or they haven't slept all that well, and then maybe more complex motor pattern learning or force expression isn't necessarily going to work, let's max out their squat, I can just sit them in the leg press and crank the reps up a bit higher and just make their legs like burn and they have to climb out of the thing. And just make sure it's like safely done, right? Not, like not using so much load through partial range of motions they're not in control of. So I become much more bullish on incorporation of machines in beginners and advanced trainees work. And in my own training, I used to laugh in my mind when I was, the new trainer, I'd see these older guys in the gym and they would just sit down on the chest press machines and whatever, and they're not using free weights. But guess what? I've kind of become that older guy where I find that a lot of the machines just simply feel better on my joints. And also, it's a bit less work to load, unload, cart dumbbells around the gym, et cetera, what have you. And some of it just feels better on my joints. So I actually much more heavily use machines in my own training. Thoughts?
I think that's great. And I think a huge question that every coach and clinician should ask their client in front of them is, what's your overall goal? Because guess what? Some people, their goal is not to do the top of the top, the most challenging squat variation, arguably the barbell back squat. Some people don't want to be barbell bench pressing. Some people don't ever want to really use a leg press machine because their sport, whether it's powerlifting or Olympic weightlifting, includes the barbell or includes more free weights. And so knowing what your clients in front of you, what their goal is going to make or break what exercises you actually prescribe for them. And it doesn't mean that the back squat is better than the leg press or leg press is better than the back squat. It is just goal dependent. And I can't stand when people will kind of crap on people who don't do any barbell or free weight work and usually just do machines and the other way around too, because my goals are probably different from your goals, which is probably different from everyone listening to this podcast right now. And the sooner strength coaches and clinicians can realize that and know that, okay, well, it's okay if Betty Sue's squat variation is the leg press and she loves the leg press. She feels good on the leg press. She doesn't have really much interest in doing a bunch of free weight squats. Yes, some free weight squat variation can be beneficial for other things like getting up and out of a chair and out of the car. But if she loves leg press, let's load up that leg press and let's really tap into building strength, increasing bone density, building more muscle mass versus saying like, oh, poo-poo on the leg press. It's not as difficult as these other variations.
Love it. If there is ever an episode where I'm going to be recommending this to like the more enthusiast listener, social media follower, this is going to be it because I think there's actually so much in it for them. But for the coaches listening, I hope you guys, if this stuff challenges any of your belief system, I want you to dig into what Susie's doing. I want you to dig in what Adam Meek is doing and Sam Spinelli and the other names we've thrown around, Michael Mash, because it's going to challenge a lot of these long-held belief systems. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with a little bit of time we got left, you've also had a lot of success on social media. And as you know, despite the fact you're a doctor of physical therapy, you're in public, you got public speaking opportunities now, you're still pretty young in this industry. Mm-hmm. So you've accomplished a lot, I think, in a slightly condensed amount of time compared to certainly someone like myself. So, and you've developed a lot of authority and like you focused on brand development. How important has it been to lean into and embrace social media where we know that people within the physical therapy realm often resist and strength mm-hmm. conditioning often resist that?
So it's funny because where I'm at today with my own career and social media was actually by complete accident, which I know some people are like, how is that by accident, Susie? Well, the thing is, I started my social media page in physical therapy school, and it actually just started off by sharing workouts. And then as I learned more, then I started sharing more rehab stuff. And then as I've grown as a clinician from more of like the black and white to the more gray area and just trying to get more people exercising and strength training, things have just slowly kind of just built up over time, which I know that's not the answer a lot of people want to hear because they're like, I want to know what your strategy is. I want to know like, you know, how you got to where you are today. Two things, embracing nuance and being myself. Because I feel like a lot of people, when they start a social media account, they're afraid of judgment. They're afraid of what people are going to think about them, which yes, rightfully so. But the sooner you just are yourself and you talk about things that are relatable to other people and you try not to be like this perfect spitting image of a coach or a physical therapist or a wife or a mom, the more people are going to resonate you with you, relate to you, and then eventually, you know, want to purchase from you your services, whether that's coaching, whether that's programs. Consistency is another big one. I, even though I didn't have any sort of strategy or sort of want to be where I'm at today, 5, 6 years ago, you still have to show up consistently. So, I mean, like I'm posting multiple times a week. I'm showing up on stories. And I am just, you know, sharing tidbits of my own personal life that can help people relate. But then I'm also sharing a bunch of useful educational information that people can watch or read my posts and then take that, implement it into their daily life, their weekly life, like then and there.
I think you've also been really good about embracing video early on as well. Mm-hmm. We're able to benefit from the sort of the growth potential because video has the largest rapid growth potential I've ever seen. Are you familiar with Rachel Henley? Did I ever connect you with Rachel?
Yes, you did. You did.
Yes, I did. I'm pretty sure. So Rachel just hit 500,000 Instagram followers. And mm-hmm. Rachel is kind of funny because I will not take an ounce of credit for, I never had anything to do with her video-based strategy. I mentored her a little bit before this. Her and a couple other coaches that she's close with. And she's one of the fastest growing social media accounts I've ever seen.
Because when did she start her account?
Can't say when she started, but I mean, she's gained that 500,000 followers within mm-hmm. probably the space of, it may be a year, certainly not more than a year and a half, which is
amazing.
Yeah. And she goes about it. She's fun. She's authentic to herself.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, she doesn't play the controversial game. She doesn't do the outrage bait. She's not an outrage merchant is a phrase I like now. And I'm seeing a lot of this stuff. And some of it, I think Goob does it from a very good place, right? He's great at it because he's calling out people are doing on a scale of bad behavior, bad things to like criminal, horrible things. But there's a lot of other people who are just clout chasing right now with outrage too, which sort of gets on my nerves. And I agree with you. I think you can build based on nuance. And I think my page has always been based on nuance. So anybody who's selling you the idea that no, you have to go into the clickbaity stuff, I really don't think you do. And I also think that the nuance applied consistently with a solid message and building a foundation of credibility and authority, this is something I believe in. Like, if coaches are just going for social media and nothing else, then you're leaving a big gap for people to look what's beyond. One of the things I've always leaned heavily on is the publications that I write for, right? Now there's public speaking, there's an event, there's a lot of other these dimensions, this podcast for a really long time. And then there's the actual client results. I'm still a full-time in-person coach. It's very, I won't say name, but there's an account that's grown rapidly, got on a lot of our radars recently, used a lot of sexist and but demeaning. Like Rachel and my pal Steve Keen, they use a lot of sexual innuendo, but they're cheeky, they're fun with it. But this account, this guy, uses a lot of demeaning, degrading, aggressive sexual innuendo. And it's formula, but it's also like I've seen information that's fundamentally biomechanically wrong. And he's getting roasted by the industry. You can build this way. And I think some people want, like, enjoy that attention. They do it deliberately. But I don't have the, I got thick skin, but I don't have the emotional stamina to be able to deal with the crap that's going to come from that approach. So I would just preach caution. But I also would say to anybody listening, like, don't discard the benefits of leaning into social media, being consistent, and the potential growth that could happen. I've seen a lot of what I would consider to be very normal everyday coaches, and I've long thought of myself in that camp, who have developed a lot of crazy opportunity and I view it in a different light because they've seen profound social media growth. Kind of how you feel too.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And something too is when you're thinking about social media, and let's say you want to grow your account and you want to, have thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers and you have your posts do well, like that's great. But you have to ask yourself, why am I posting on social media? Do I want to do it just because I want to have a following, or am I doing it because I want to help people? Normally, the second option of wanting to help people is what is going to maybe not grow your account as fast, but having that as your main driving force is what's going to attract people to your page, which are then probably most likely going to purchase your services because you are chasing after trying to help them versus just trying to just grow this account on social media, whether it's with call out culture or whether it is using like a bunch of demeaning sexual innuendos, which if that's your cup of tea and that's what you want to go for, fine. But no, there's also this other realm where we are fueled by this because I genuinely want to help people, especially women, get into strength training.
And you're doing a great job of that. So where can everybody listening, obviously enthusiasts for all the stuff we just talked about and more, but other coaches to see what you're doing, follow you, engage with you, how do they find you?
They can find me at Dr.Susie.Squats on Instagram and on TikTok. Instagram is my main platform. And then my website is www.moveyourbonespt.com.
Move your bones. Love it.
Yes,
All right.
move your bones.
I am getting better and better at the consistency. Again, I've been so consistent for so many years. This year has been chaos, but I'm trying to bring great quality guests and interviews. I've actually kind of gotten away from the idea that I need to have a weekly episode. I'll try, but I will not force it and fill in. Instead, I want to make sure the guests I bring in you guys are amazing conversations. So please take this episode. This one is, I think, I've had a lot of smart physical therapists on here before, but I don't think we've ever had a conversation white like this that I think is so tactical about the stuff we went over. So if you think this was great, please share this episode and Susie with someone in your world, another coach who would benefit from this stuff. And just thanks for being here, guys. Susie, thank you so much. And
Thank you.
we'll see you hopefully next week. If everything goes according to plan, I have a really cool guest. I'm wearing a tulle shirt, so there's sort of a you have to listen to figure out what's a connection to the band Tool, my favorite band. Okay. It's kind of cool. All right. Thanks, guys. Take care.